From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Julia Sweeney is a comedian, an actress, and an author. She did four seasons on Saturday Night Live. She's written and performed one-woman shows, including God Said Ha, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Julia Sweeney has a new book of essays out called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. It's about her burning desire to have a family and how it turned into a burning desire to get away from them. Julia Sweeney comes from Spokane, and she went to the University of Washington right here. And I want to talk to you about the book, but I want to talk about Spokane, too. Is that a good
sure.
place? Is that a good place to come from?
Oh, my gosh. The best. I love Spokane. I could live there again, I think.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
It falls right through the center of the city.
Yeah, and I like it. It's kind of far enough away from Seattle. Like, it's its own entity. It isn't overshadowed by any other big city. Like, it's just kind of itself. And it sort of has a Midwest feeling. I like the weather. You know, it's not rainy all the time. It has the four seasons. And there's a lot of outdoor stuff to do. And the downtown sort of was preserved because it was depressed for so long. So there's a lot of old buildings that stayed
yeah.
that are pretty. And it's kind of up and coming. Like, I feel like Spokane could be an Austin, Texas in 20 years or
so. Well, the last time I was there, they had a knitting factory, which was this
yes!
hip club in New York City. And there's a knitting factory in Spokane.
What's I up know. I know it.
So, yeah. You must have been there, if I did my math right, maybe you were about 15 when Expo 74,
oh my gosh.
The World
Seminal
Fair
lifetime experience.
Tell me about what it was like
well,
to be there.
Well, first
then.
It was, I was 14 and I had huge breasts and that's all I really remember about that. I wore a tank top, I put on short shorts, and I walked through Expo 74 every
day. I
bet
you were popular.
I was very popular then. I think mm-hmm. I was at the height of my sexuality at 14. I think if I'd been in a tribe, I would have been married off exactly at age 14.
But you did not. You went on to higher
no.
education
yes.
here in Seattle at the University
yes.
of Washington, and you were studying economics?
Yes. I studied economics and European history, was my double major at the U of Dub.
What was the life plan when you went into that that major?
Well, I wanted to be a European history major, and my mother went crazy because she didn't. She goes, what are you going to do with a degree in European history besides be a waitress who reads about European history on her break? And she wanted me to go into business, but she didn't know the difference between economics and business. So my parents really pressured me to take a business class. And when I signed up for Economics 101, I guess in their minds that was a business class, which it totally wasn't. It was really just like theory and ideas. And I loved it, actually. I totally fell in love with economics. So I got a degree in it. And then I also got a degree in European history. And then I didn't use either of those degrees.
Oh, so. What about campus life when you were a college student here at the University of Washington? Did you hang it on the Ave? What was it like?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. First I worked at the Varsity Theater for the whole time I was here, 4 years. Okay. And I worked a lot. Like, I worked 5 nights a week at the Varsity Theater. That was my main job. And then I was also a Delta Gamma for a couple of years in the sorority system, which was not exactly for me, even though it was okay. But it was not really for me, but it was... I have some fond memories of that.
Yeah? You're going to stop by the sorority house while you're here? Say hi to the...
No.
Okay. Don't expect her to show up.
It was... I'm sure the culture is different now. When I was there, it still had this leftover, really old-fashioned culture about it where, you know, girls were looking for husbands, you know, and mm-hmm. it was a lot of socializing in ways that, you know, I wanted to be like an intellectual sitting in a coffee house playing chess and discussing Sartre or something. I don't know. I never did that either, but that was my idea of mm-hmm. college, and it wasn't really matching up with the sorority. And then I became student body vice president, which I was for 2 years.
Wow. Did you have to have all those, you know, I see all those signs over
yes.
at the university. You had to have like a ton of Julia Sweeney signs
yes.
out to get your name out there.
And really the only reason I became student body vice president is because I wanted to have an office next to Jim Emerson, who was my friend who ran the film series there.
And
that was the way to get next to him was to be, I came to visit him. I was like, what is the office next door? Oh, that's student body vice president. I was like, fantastic. I'll run for student body vice president. Then I can have the office next to you.
Well, so you got elected, you got the office, but
yes.
was your view on politics soured forever after that experience?
No. In fact, I had a really good experience doing it. I got involved. You know, I learned a lot about how campus politics worked. And I had friends there, Clayton Lewis, Kathy Wareham, who did go into some politics afterwards. And I look back sometimes and wonder why I didn't do that because I enjoyed it. I liked running for office.
Not too late.
Well, maybe.
Al Franken.
I know, Al Franken. Al Franken. I don't know.
You wouldn't be the first Seattle.
I would have a lot of hurdles. I've said too much. I'm an atheist right there. I would never get elected to anything.
That could be a big problem. Julia Sweeney is my guest. She has a new memoir out called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. And I just want to ask one more question about your past. I found it really interesting that you were working as an accountant when you first started performing with the Los Angeles improv group, The Groundlings. That's such an interesting transition.
Well, funnily enough, it relates to my economics degree because I had the economics degree, European history, but I'd taken a lot of film classes from Richard Jameson and Kathleen Murphy, who were teaching at that time at the university. And I was really in love with film. And I thought, I know, I'll go be an accountant in the film industry.
That'll be your in.
That'll be my in. And so I went to LA and I did indeed get a job as an accountant at Columbia Pictures. And I liked it at first. The first couple of years were really fun. And then in order to really get ahead, you had to get an MBA or a law degree. And I just wasn't interested enough in it. And I really secretly, inside, I was a performer. And then I found an ad for the Groundlings Theater that was teaching classes. And it said you could be a non-professional actor and still take classes at the Groundlings Theater in improvisation. And that was just like a light bulb went off. And after the first class, I was like, okay, this is it. I'm changing my whole life.
Were you off to a quick start? Were you making people laugh like right away? Did you realize I got something here? I can make it better.
Well, it was always funny, but I didn't know how to harness my funny. Yeah. And the Groundlings really taught me that. So in a sense, I don't know how to answer your question because I was funny, but I didn't necessarily do well at improv. In fact, I flunked my first class. I had to repeat beginners because there's a lot of rules and there's a lot of ways of being to, you know, harness yourself in an improvisation situation that I had to learn. And so and it helped me develop my sense of humor, too. I mean, I guess I was always kind of funny, but I didn't know how to use it.
That's really interesting. What is that? What do you mean by develop a sense of humor? You had it. What does it mean to develop a sense of humor?
Well, I don't know if you can teach seeing absurdity in situations, which to me is the basis of most humor. But I mean, I do meet people who I just think, no, they don't have that way of seeing. On the other hand, in improv, I learn techniques like Phil Hartman, who was one of my teachers at the Groundlings. He would teach you things like he would say, think of a relative in your family that you know very well. And now think of a Warner Brothers cartoon character and marry those two together and create a character on stage that is using, you know, your Daffy Duck and your, you know, cousin, you know, so-and-some Rosemary or whatever, and create this character out of those two influences equally. And you would often come up with really funny characters doing that. And that, so there is a kind of mechanism to being funny in a way that I learned there.
Julia Sweeney is with me, and her new book of essays, or memoir really, is called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. Now, is someone going to investigate this and find out that there's the lies and misrepresentations in here? Is this the real thing or what? Is it an authentic memoir?
It is,
or
authentic.
Is Joe's 1 through 12 kind of composites?
I would say sometimes I have details in there that protect certain people. I would say that's true. But no, it's true. Yeah, it's true.
A lot of it has to do with your experience in adopting a child. And you started to look at adopting a baby from China, but a gynecologist said you should rethink that and
that's right.
Look at another country, maybe.
Yes, he was a Lebanese gynecologist in Beverly Hills who said, you're funny. China, they don't laugh enough. You should adopt a Brazilian baby. Brazilian babies laugh a lot. That's what he said. And I said, you know, I'm not really looking for an audience. I'm looking for a child to parent. And I go, we're talking about a baby. That's ridiculous. And then I laughed, and then he didn't laugh because he was serious. He really thought I should adopt a baby from Brazil.
But was he right? Does Mulan
No,
laugh?
Mulan laughs.
Okay.
She's got a good sense of humor. Yes.
She must be about 13 now?
Yeah, 13 and a half.
Okay. And is she totally head on into teenagedom?
Yes, she is.
In the rebellious kind of annoying sense?
Or? Well, I will see how things, you know, like in some senses she's very shy and kind of a homebody. Like she likes to spend her weekends with us, me and my husband. I recently said to her, don't you have friends you want to go hang out with? She goes, you know, I really just enjoy being at home with you guys.
How flattering.
I know it. I don't know how long that will last. She's only 13.
I'll keep your fingers crossed.
I know. But I'm hoping like maybe she'll be one of those really introverted, shy people who stays home all the time. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. This process of adopting a baby from China, I know some people who've done that, and they just described this amazing experience of getting there and going through this whole process. And they went to a village, and they're waiting for the children, and all of a sudden these motor scooters come down the road with drivers and nurses on the back holding babies, and they get off the motor scooter and hand the baby to the child. And she described this process of actually getting the child.
Oh my gosh.
What was it like for you?
It was not like that. That sounds fantastic. My way was not terrible, but it was just very perfunctory. And, you know, like we were at this hotel in Guangzhou, and the hotels in China at that time, I haven't been there for 10 years, so maybe it's changed a little, but it was kind of garish, you know, and the decor was kind of like, just kind of garish. That's the word that keeps coming up. But we were in like this big ballroom, and they had all the people who were adopting herded onto one side of the room. And then your name was called and you went to the other side of the room. And then from behind you, like basically where you can't see, but the crowd can see, came Norman, who was the adoption facilitator, with the baby that he would hold up over his head for everyone to see. Except for you. You did not see the baby, but everyone else did. And then he would hand you the baby. And then they also, for our adoption experience, they played some emotional music. And it was just this old 80s boombox. I'm sure that's changed now, but this is 10 years ago. And they pushed a button, and out came the theme to the Titanic. And that was how we got our babies.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Julia Sweeney, I noticed that you're the voice of Mrs. Squibbles.
Yes.
In the new Pixar film, Monsters University. And I always thought that voice work, that's got to be the easiest, best paying job in the world.
It is.
It's all that.
Except that don't tell anyone. I don't want any more competition. It's the absolute best. That's the dream of the dream of the dream of the dream. Mm-hmm. You don't have to memorize lines. You don't have to put on makeup. Doesn't matter how you look. And actually, you can put all your energy into your voice. I mean, you kind of know this, being a voice person. It's really fun not to have to worry about anything but how something sounds. I love it. I've done not a ton of it, but I've done a fair amount of voiceover work, and I love it, and I would take it over regular acting anytime.
I get a big kick out of going to films and hearing a voice and going, wait a minute, that's Julia Sweeney coming out of that voice.
Yes.
But that made me wonder whether that's kind of something that they have in mind when they hire voice talent, or are you hired strictly because you've got good vocal chops?
I don't know. This one, I didn't audition for this part. Mm-hmm. They just called and asked me to do it, which is fantastic.
Job, here you go.
But the character that I play is like this really overweight woman who's a monster. She has five eyes, but she often has curlers in her hair and she's, you know, unattractive. And I wondered if they created the character based on me. I was like, now which came first, the idea for the character or my idea for the voice? I don't know.
You did this. You had a little part in Pulp Fiction.
Yes, very
and,
small.
And I understand you're friends with Quentin Tarantino, and he directed the film of God Said Ha.
Actually, he didn't.
He produced it. Okay, and you directed it.
But it was a two-day shoot, and he was there the whole time.
But
telling me what to do.
This seems like the oddest couple in the world, because you're sort of warm and funny, and Quentin Tarantino has other things to him, but he doesn't seem at all like the kind of personality that you project.
I think of him as warm and funny, but I know him in a different way. And also, I have to say, I'm not really close with him now. I mean, we're acquaintances now, but there was a period of time when we were very close and in contact all the time. He's such an enthusiast that to me, that's warm and funny on steroids, an enthusiast. Mm-hmm. So I guess I do think of him like as warm and funny. But it's funny, I guess. Yeah, I guess I see him in a little bit different way than the public might.
Mm-hmm. it's not one thing, it's your mother. You talk about adopting your child and kind of your reverse family, child first, husband later. And you recount a lot of your ways to the husband, and I alluded to this earlier, but they're all Joe.
Yes.
All the former boyfriends are Joe in your memoir. Joe 1 through 12 or 13.
Yes. I just sort of randomly assign the first Joe when the book starts as Joe number 10. And I think I'm 37 when the book starts. Right now I'm 53. So it's a long period of time. Although I've had a lot of people say, God, you have so many boyfriends. And I was thinking, that is like four boyfriends over a 15-year period. That's not a lot of boyfriends.
That's not that many boyfriends.
No, it isn't. It's just that you're reading about them all in one chapter. That's why it seems like there's a lot of boyfriends.
Now, those Joes, or at least some of those Joes, are probably going to read it and see your portrayal of them.
I know. No, I know. Have. Actually have. I've already gotten one response that, I don't know, it's hard because I don't know. What's right?
Was this Joe upset or just...
He was upset that I said he wasn't funny. He said, I know, and I feel bad. Should I have not said that? I thought it was important to write that.
Just earlier in this interview, Julia, you said there are people who are not funny. You kind of drew a line there.
Well, this particular person wasn't even trying to be funny. So I didn't know why you could, like, if somebody said about me that I wasn't a good, you know, tightrope walker, I would not be upset by that. I'm not even trying to be a tightrope walker. So I feel this way about that guy. But I think being funny, people want to feel like they're funny no matter what they're trying to do or not try to do.
It's kind of more personal than tightrope walker.
I know it is.
Everyone
but
likes
I felt,
to think they're funny
I
sometimes.
Did feel bad. I felt bad. I did. I felt bad. And then I had another guy upset that he wasn't in it because I didn't include one very quick boyfriend experience in there. He wrote me and
where
said,
am I?
Where am I?
I was Joe 10 and a half.
Exactly.
Cut me out.
I was like, oh, please.
And you talk also about meeting your husband. And it's an interesting story to it. You did this monologue called Letting Go of God that you performed. It was on This American Life and elsewhere. And that led to meeting your husband through the subject line of an email. Tell us how that happened.
I was getting a lot of email at the time because of This American Life, like really hundreds of emails. And one of the email's headline was Desperately Seeking Sweeney-in-Law. And it said, I'm writing to you to propose marriage to you on behalf of my brother who doesn't know that I'm writing to you. You are the perfect woman for him. I would propose to you myself, but I'm gay and I live in San Francisco, so it wouldn't work out between us, but you and my brother are the ideal couple. And then it went on to tell him about his brother and how he had this, he couldn't date anyone who was religious or believed in God in any way. And so I was doing this show. And over a course of a year, I ended up meeting the mother, the friend, and the guy who wrote the letter. And I eventually wrote this guy who was mortified that he had been set up this way.
You met all these other people before you met the guy who became your husband.
Wow. Yes, because I didn't respond to the letter. It was a good letter, but I didn't respond. Mm-hmm. Then I ran into someone in New York who said, my friend wrote this letter proposing marriage on behalf of his brother. And I said, oh, yeah. And she said, I just want to vouch for him and his brother. I've known them since high school. They're really funny. Then, like, 9 months later, I was doing another show in L.A., and I ran into the guy who wrote the letter, and he introduced me to his mother, who was really funny. And then I said, well, maybe I will write your brother. And he said, no, now I don't want you to write my brother because he's a jerk, and we're in a big fight, and we're not speaking right now. So then I wrote to the brother just to say, speak to your brother. It's okay. And then we ended up in this email correspondence, and then we eventually got married. That's basically how it happened.
And you'll have to find out the rest of it by reading. If it's not one thing, it's your mother. And you'll have to find out the story of the title, which is also an interesting story. Julia Sweeney, thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Julia Sweeney. David Hyde produces our show with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Hannah Byrne, Cameron Drews, and Andy Hurst, and Amber Cortez. Jack Walters is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds.